Scientific Imagination is part of the Future-Based platform. My name is Sabine Winters. For more information, visit scientificimagination.org.
Mika Seysel is a two-time TEDx speaker, frequent lecturer and mentor at the academic institutions, organizations and creative tech companies such as Israeli Space Agency, the Ramon Foundation, Explore Mars and many, many more. She is a graduate of the Architecture and Urban Planning Faculty at the Technion Israel's Institute of Technology and the Politecnico di Milano. And she's an International Space University program alumni with a mission to create a built environment in space and on Earth that fits the needs of its diverse users to ensure not only a surviving but thriving human society. Mika is actively raising awareness for gender and human equality through work with international organizations such as UN Women, among other. Mika promotes courageous creative thinking, innovation through extreme conditions, and encourages all to become passionate change agents. Very, very warm welcome, Mika.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
I got to know your work via a presentation for the Seeds Network, a space and art platform, among other initiated by Angelo Vermeulen, who was my previous guest. And you talked, among other, about your Mars is More project. What really struck me was your enthusiasm, your energy during the talk, but also a sense of determination. What motivated you to follow this path throughout your study and career?
Well, I kind of stumbled upon what I'm doing now, which is space architecture, which basically means, by the way, that is design and research of living environments for humans outside of Earth. But originally, I never thought that this even exists. I never knew that there is such a thing as space architecture. Initially, I wanted to study architecture because, one, I was always drawn to cities and buildings and the way that the buildings impact how we behave. But also, I wanted to do something that kind of combines both parts of the brain, the creative part and the analytic part. And then I started to specialize in skyscrapers and large-scale projects in Israel and also in New York. And my original dream was to have as many buildings around the world as possible with my name on them. I loved skyscrapers because they're essentially very, very, very big puzzles. Thing is that once, as I was working in New York, I realized that when I work on large-scale projects, I'm usually the only woman in the room. And I started to investigate if there is a relationship between the fact that the majority of the infrastructure of our environment was designed by men and the way that other people that are not similar to those types of people that were designing everything, if it has an impact on our lives. And I started with women specifically. And I kind of found competition that I could really experiment with what a new and complete different environment could be on Mars. So I did there an equality-driven architecture settlement where I could really start to experiment with what these things could be. How can we do things differently? So it was never really a straight path. Reason that I got there is because I was flexible enough to just go with the flow and say yes to crazy and strange opportunities that came my way. So it was never something that I aimed for. But right now I'm very much focused
on space architecture, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just space architecture. It's actually to create change in the way people will live in space, but also how we will live here on Earth, that I can do by designing for space, because designing for space is in many ways designing for the future of Earth.
Yeah, we will come back to that. But you recently joined the International Space University program. How was that?
It was incredible. I mean, since the fact that there is nowhere in the world to actually study space architecture, there is one place, one university in Texas that they do have a space architecture master's degree, if I'm not mistaken, but they are focusing on materials and structures and more on the engineering side, even though it's called architecture. So there isn't really a place to study that. So for me, the International Space University was my way to really get formal education about space. Anything from planets and conditions on other planets, physics and actual rocket science, to understand how we can launch things and satellites and all these different aspects of space that is not necessarily architecture, just so I'll be able to really have a deeper understanding. So yeah, so it was an incredible experience. I think people that don't experience it firsthand don't really really grasp the craziness of it, because you really study and you are with everyone 24/7 for the entire duration of the program, and you just live and breathe space and you get to geek out with people that are like you.
It's quite intense as well, right?
It is. And also we were 36 people from 21 different countries in a few different time zones. So there were people that were waking up every day at 3 a.m. to join class. And in the beginning, they said something interesting. They told us, imagine that you're all on a journey in space and you're living in a different time zone. You are now on the SSP time zone, and everyone should kind of live by that and forget about the Earth or your country's time zone for the duration of the program.
So already there, imagination plays a role in getting together and thinking together about space possibilities. Speaking of which, on your website, it says that you are an architecture and innovation lab where imagination design comes together to create the future of built environments. Also, innovation is often connected with imagination. What kind of role does imagination play with innovation for you?
I started out as an architecture studio, and I realized that what I do is not regular architecture. So we do a lot of research and we do a lot of strange projects or unusual projects. One very excited project we recently took part in was to design a permanent settlement or permanent structure for the Burning Man Festival in Nevada, in the US, in the Nevada desert. And the reason why I did this project, I was approached by a team of artists from Milan called Pixel, and they were supported by Siemens, and they were our consultants. And the reason why I took on this project was because it was an opportunity to design closed loop architecture, which is what we try to focus on in space, since space is very dangerous and people can't survive in space without aids or artificial environments. We need to have closed loop systems. That means that we have to produce our own energy, we have to grow our own food, we have to create our own heat and cooling, filter our own water, and be completely independent and not reliant on any other external resources, basically. So in the Nevada desert, also, it's an extreme environment. It's a desert. It gets very, very hot and very, very cold. So it was an opportunity to, and it's far away from civilization, kind of. So it's an opportunity to really experiment with closed loop systems. And this is what we did. And we created a structure called Puha, which is in the language of the original people that used to live in that land, in that area. And it's the mother of everything. And we created a sort of a ring system or Arduino system, which means that it's a structure that you can add and take out rings depending on what you need. So you can add more solar panel rings if you need more energy. You can add more cooling rings if you need more cooling. You can add more light rings. And if you can imagine, it's kind of diagonal kind of ring structure that parts of it is protruding outside of the land and parts of it are underneath, underground. And that was a very, very interesting project because you really can take that concept and put it anywhere else, if it's on Earth, anywhere else in terms of extreme environments. It can be underwater, it can be in a very cold place, it can be in the forest, and also we can translate it to space as well, to Mars, for example. And the other things that I want to mention are researches that we're doing, because they are part of what we do in, when you think about a lab. You think that we may do research, and we're conducting three different types of researches these days. One of them is space habitability research, where we look into analog habitats on Earth to understand the human experience. The second one is how different disabilities on Earth can actually become superpowers in space. And the third one is the personal space research, pun intended. In space, people live in very, very small environments, and they have to get along with each other. And a lot of times, people from different genders, cultures, and ages, they feel comfortable with different distances from other people. So we really have to be cautious of that, not to invade personal space of other people in order to keep the peace and to for the success of the mission. But it's also true for Earth. We are living in smaller and smaller and smaller environments. Our living quarters are getting smaller, and we are doing a lot of co-working, co-transportation, even co-living or co-cooking if you have a small apartment, but the kitchen is joined with other people. So we really have to understand how to get along and how to respect other people's personal space. And since the world is getting smaller and we're interacting with people from all over the world. It's really important to understand those differences. So these are just like a taste of what we are doing right now. You can't do this without having imagination. I think you can't be an architect even without using your imagination to some certain degree. And there is a really big conflict for me. When you study architecture, the first thing that you study about is the history of architecture. And the reasoning is that you have to understand what happened in the past in order to innovate in the future. I don't know what I feel about it. I mean, it's true. You have to understand those things. But when I think about space, the more I learn about sci-fi and things that people are creating in terms of movies and books and things like that, it kind of limits the imagination. And it kind of unconsciously sometimes make us replicate what we saw or what we read. So for me, because I was never a space enthusiast until 4 years ago, I have the advantage of never seeing most of cult reason and reading most of the cult books. So I try to really stay away from that in order for me not to be impacted into creating things or replicating things that I read about or seen. Yeah, and I have a friend though, I always check with him. I have a friend who is a real space enthusiast, sci-fi enthusiast. He's seen everything, he read everything. I always like check with him, ask him, hey, did anyone create this before? Did you see it somewhere? Did I unconsciously see it somewhere and replicated it? So I always check with him, but I try not to see things myself.
So you really try to create your own narrative.
Yeah, that's my goal.
We had an introduction conversation and you told me that, for example, everyday surroundings really needs a different approach when it comes to face architecture. You mentioned the example of the K-stairs. Well, stairs just do not have a function anymore in space because of the absence of gravity.
Yeah.
Can you explain, maybe with examples, how space will influence how we look at architecture, not only in space itself, but also here on Earth?
Before I got into space, I started to look into architecture on Earth and to see what are we using because we need it, and what are we using because we're used to it. And maybe it's not relevant anymore. If we look at timelines of cities around the world, cities were like the bigger cities were designed a few hundred years ago, right? And those times where the social structure was completely different. And a lot of times we still use that infrastructure, although it was designed in times that were completely different. Now, one of the things that I noticed, and I also always compared it or took it against the question, is it safe for women? Is it safe for minorities? Is it safe? Like, safety was something that I tried to check all these things against, or to bounce it against. And one of the things that I noticed was that we have been using two ways to go vertically in buildings since always, which is staircases and elevators later on. And that's it. This is how we're going up and down buildings. And when you look into safety issues, you see that a lot of crime happens in staircases. And if you look at New York, for example, and in New York, there are areas that are called projects. And those are areas of towers or high-rise buildings where the people that are living there are very low income. So they don't have money to maintain the elevators that exist in their buildings. So the elevators essentially don't work, and they have very, very high stair shafts or staircases. And a lot of the crime happens in those staircases because essentially they are confined. People can't, it's harder to escape. But also, if you look at ourselves in regular places, in a building, or even when you are in an elevator with someone that you don't know, maybe you can get a feeling that if something would happen, you have no way out. So the fact that space has different types of gravity helped me start to think about how we can go vertically in buildings without using stairs and elevators in a much safer way. On Mars, for example, there is a third of gravity than what we have here on Earth. So that means that everything weighs a third. And I was thinking, okay, so if everything weighs a third, maybe, and this is an assumption, I didn't test it yet, but I said, maybe if we put machines that are, I call them suction boosters, on the ceiling, and we just do a little hop, will it be able to help us kind of jump up from floor to floor, or prevent our fall if we want to jump down to lower floors? And once I thought about that on Mars, I was like, okay, how can we translate it back here to Earth? Maybe we should use trampolines. Maybe we should use harnesses that we just clip ourselves to the wall or something, or small individual capsules that can kind of shoot us all around the building, maybe not even just vertically. But I think that there is room for innovating, and space kind of, because it's so different, it helps us think about things differently, how we would do things differently because the environment is different, the conditions are different, and then we can really create change back here. Because when we are here, it's really hard for us to imagine things being done differently, things that we are so used to.
You say that space for you is a method to imagine alternatives here on Earth, then.
Yeah, it's a I use it as a creative thinking tool or creative playground.
How does that work, though? How do you start? You get inspiration or maybe an assignment or an idea, and then...
Yeah, I mean, the first thing, like I mentioned, what you have in your background is the first time that I ever did anything in space, which was my Martian settlement. And I just started reading about Mars. And the inspiration came from its condition. And so many, you can live your whole life just working on the conditions, like imagining and playing off of the conditions on Mars, because they're really, really cool things. I mean, there are the usual things that actual people that are working in the space industry are really battling or trying to solve, which is the high radiation and the very, very cold temperatures. And of course, these are things that we have to consider. But Mars has 24 hours and 40 minutes a day, which is awesome in my mind. And it's really interesting. How would our day change with extra 40 minutes? Will it change? Does the architecture need to change accordingly to support it or not? Or no, the sky on Mars during the day is red, and the sunrises are red and the sunsets are blue. And the Mars land is reddish orangey because they have a lot of iron there. So it's kind of rusted on the surface. So the environment is completely red, basically. The sky, the ground, if we would have liquid water on the surface, maybe that would reflect the redness as well. So how do we maintain, or how do we contrast that to create psychological benefits? So that's a whole thing that has to do with color and its influence on our brain and on our psychology and on our well-being. And red is a pretty intense color also. It's not that everything is green. And the gravity is interesting. So there are a lot of elements on Mars that are very, very interesting. And then when you look at the moon, for example, you get a whole new set of conditions. The gravity is 1/6 of Earth. Then you get 14 days of daylight and 14 days of night. And then if you go to the International Space Station, you get microgravity. It's not zero gravity, because they do have gravity from Earth. The reason that they are floating around is because they are free falling constantly. They are circling the Earth 17,500 miles per hour, which is 16 times a day. So there they don't even use their legs. They're just floating around and they're using their hands. So on the International Space Station, because they're not using their hands today, still to send things to space costs a lot of money. Every kilo or pound costs a lot of money to send to space. I was thinking, what if Paralympic athletes that are amputees, that they don't have legs, they are completely healthy, they have healthy body and they're very strong, but they don't have legs, so they weigh less, and they can be an amazing astronauts because they only need to use their hands. They're more compact. We have an issue with physical space in space. Everything needs to be smaller. So maybe they can be amazing, amazing astronauts. And that led me to understand that disabilities are only disabilities because their environment makes the people disabled or not able to do something. But if the environment was fit, those disabilities would disappear. They were able to do anything. So it's just differences of abilities that are not really disabilities. And if we start to look at that in that way, people just have different abilities, then definitely some people with different abilities can be an amazing, amazing assets to space exploration.
Wow. So the conditions, for example, in space on Mars create for you the playground, which gets your imagination going to focus on equality-driven architecture or new structures of society. Or
yeah, I think that my creative juices or my imagination flows because of the fact that I'm constantly discovering new things in space. And I'm like, oh my God, how can we use that? How can we use the specific gravity? How can we use the specific conditions? How can it change? So I try to take away or chip away anything that can slow people down or anything that can hurt different types of people. I try to really pinpoint all the different things that can really create disabilities for different people. And it can be people with physical disabilities. It can be different body proportions. It can be different ages. I mean, and everything really is tied in together with the built environment. The built environment is the support system for everything else.
Could you mention examples of architecture that is not diverse or exclude groups of people?
Yeah, definitely. So first thing that I always talk about, I think every woman, and I think also men are very much aware of this. When you go to the theater or to the movies or to a public place, and you want to go to the bathroom, to use the restrooms, you always see a line outside of the women's restrooms. And you never see a line outside of the men's. This is like a global phenomena that we have everywhere. And we just know that this is the way it is. And women know that if we are now seeing a concert and want to use the restrooms, we have to maybe get out like a minute before the intermission to not stand in the line. So accept it and we work around it. The reality is that this is a flaw of design. The building code all over the world tells architects how many stalls to put in the ladies' bathrooms and in the men's bathrooms. Also, it says, do you or do you not put unisex bathrooms? By the way, this is just like something else, but it's also something that influences the way we behave and how people feel. It doesn't say that we need to have enough stalls for the ladies. And research shows that women take 3 times longer to use the bathrooms than men. So it's a very simple mathematical kind of problem that we can solve very easily, yet nobody's solving it and nobody's raising even the flag because we just accept it. So this is just one very, very common example. Another interesting example that I learned about a few years back, in New York, there are bridges going from Manhattan to Long Island. They were designed by an architect called Robert Moses, and he designed those bridges particularly low. And the reason that he did that was because he didn't want buses to be able to go under these bridges. He only wanted private cars to be able to go under these bridges. Now, these bridges, if you go under them, you get to more luxurious or expensive areas. By preventing buses going under these bridges, he actually prevented people from low-income communities that don't have private cars and don't have money for cabs or taxis, that only rely on buses, to actually reach those areas. So it's a very, harsh and interesting way that an architect used to really influence the population of a certain area. And they have those bridges until now, and they have these signs there that says, watch out, buses and trucks can go under, there are low bridges. They are still there. Another very common example is if you look at the Apple stores around the world. Apple stores actually wrote a patent about like the way that they designed those glass structures. Usually it's like a glass box overground, and you go down stairs and the store is underground in many places, not in all places, but the stairs and the railings are glass. And even though the steps themselves are opaque, the railings are completely clear. And if people, men or women, wearing skirts or dresses that are going down these stairs, and the majority of the activities happening under those stairs, people just can look up and they can see up their skirts or dresses. You know, I think as a woman going down those stairs, if you're wearing a skirt, maybe you notice it, maybe you think about it, maybe you don't. If you do think about it, you probably would move to the side and you're like, why would you need to do that? I mean, why don't you think about these people when you are designing? And there are many, the list goes on and on and on, I think.
You are working really towards a more inclusive future through architecture. Among other, we already talked about your Martian settlement, the Mars is More project, and it has a donut shape. Is this something that merits inclusiveness? How does it work?
Yeah, so I was, when I started out with this project, I started to look into the history of architecture. And in the beginning, people used to settle in circular structures or circular community, even if it's in tents, or the village was a bunch of tents or structures that were organized in a circular way. And even if we look at cities in Europe, like Milan or Paris, if we look at that, there usually are cities that have a wall around them. And the reason for that was, one, that it was easier to guard from danger because you don't have edges, so nothing can creep up on you. And also, it's a way that people feel more equal. If you think about how we sit around a campfire, how we sit around a round table, it's something that makes people feel that every person gets an equal kind of spot. that's kind of derives from looking at how we used to settle. But then I also added to that another layer, which is the functions that I can place when I use those ring-shaped structures. And if we place the public functions in the center of the ring and we surround them by the residential area, that means that always we have eyes on what's happening in the center. So there are nowhere that you can hide and do something bad, or you feel more protected because you know that there are people seeing inside. And it's also something that can be very useful if you imagine if you would want to create a school or a kindergarten. If they are inside and then there is a ring of houses around it, and just outside of that, there are roads and things like that, it's much more protected. So that shape kind of allowed me to, one, create something that we can slice up and divide equally. It's also something that is in our joint memory. Like, we understand it as something more equal, and also in the functional essence of it.
It's like almost like some sort of reverse panopticon. Now you reverse also the power structures and a society taking care of what's happening inside of the ring.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that happened, it stopped these types of settlements to be built, the round settlements on Earth. Two things. One is, as they got bigger and bigger, they got to different or more difficult topography. Mm-hmm. And since they were lacking the technology, they had to design to work around it, and they couldn't just continue building in those concentric kind of forms. But also, once religion and governance came into play. So once those things started to happen, you started to build structures or buildings for these things, there were big buildings that were usually in the center. Everything was revolving them. And kind of like what you mentioned, that was the center, and that was the guard looking out, and it kind of reshuffled the dynamic or the power dynamic of the built environment or the public space. So it wasn't something that is an open courtyard for the people in the center, and everyone kind of surrounds it, and people can come in and talk and, you know, do their thing every day, but they are now looking at the thing that they are afraid of. They're looking at something that governs them or that controls them and different types of ways.
Is architecture for you a way to integrate ideals or maybe even utopian thinking into society?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I gave a talk a few months back, and I was told that what I talk about is less architecture and more philosophy.
Yeah. Architecture is the early adopter of philosophy. Indeed, I hear a lot of philosophical thoughts in your...
Yeah, because architecture really influences the way we behave. People don't realize it, but it's a way to control people.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the floor plan, the blueprint of a prison, and you put it next to the blueprint of 19th, 20th century schools, it's the same structure. It's the same blueprint, because this is what they wanted. They wanted a way to use architecture to control the flow of the students or the flow of the prisoners, to have little cells or little classrooms where they are controlled. So it's very, very interesting. And also, if you imagine a regular home of a family, some families have one living room for the entire family, and some families have a family room or a kid's room. And then they divide the area for the adults from the area of the children. That really influences the flow and the vibe and the relationships within that family. They will be more separated, whereas the family with the one living room maybe will be noisier, maybe will be more cluttered, but they will be more together. So architecture really has a way to arrange and to influence the way we think, the way we feel, the way we behave. It can make us feel safe. It can make us feel unsafe or uncomfortable. Some say that architecture is part of the philosophy, psychology. I mean, you have to know and to be aware of those things when you design. And when you get an opportunity to design in space and to really reimagine how we could live somewhere else, far, far away, with completely different conditions, you can't not... What language will they talk, and how will it impact the architecture? What will be the form of governance there? How it will work? Will they settle by country? Will they settle together? Will they bring their cultures from home, from their home countries? I mean, there are so many questions that are philosophical almost that can influence the way we design there. And I think that's very, very interesting. Also, the whole I mentioned before, living in smaller areas or living in more crowded areas. I mean, if you look at crowded areas in India, for example, there is a lot of sexual harassment in the on the streets there. People can't really control that or prevent that because it's so tight and people, there are so many people all over the place in certain parts of India, for example. And how can architecture help that? And we are going towards that reality in New York and in many other big cities. And how can we create the environments that will be safer? One of the things that you see or don't see from space is borders when you look back at Earth, borders between countries.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about it, it makes you wonder, do countries serve us still? And you can get into that whole way of thinking if maybe we should settle in different ways and not by geographic presence in terms of you conquered a certain area. And then what would the architecture look if all the cultures will be, you know, smushed together and combined?
Does imagination allow you a space for discovery then? Is it in this way connected to innovation?
I mean, I think innovation, there are two types of innovation. One is making things better or improving something that is already existing. And the second one is completely disrupting something, completely change the way we look at something or the way we use something. These are like the two types of innovation. And I think that definitely space architecture and thinking about how we should live in space or we could live in space. And by the way, it's not just one possibilities, it's many different types of futures that we have to consider. I think it definitely can create innovative ideas and innovation. I mean, there's no way around it. If we are thinking about things in completely different environments, it will be completely different. And a lot of things that we are using today, it's not necessarily architecture, but a lot of things that we are using today were invented for space and we don't even know it. Velcro, you know, like we use to stick things to one another without glue, that was invented for astronauts because they needed to put things on the walls of the International Space Station or their spacecrafts so things will not float around all the time. Very, very small cameras that we have now on our phones, they were invented for astronauts. Wireless was first invented for space because the wires were floating around and they needed things to be wireless. A lot of innovations that we're using now on Earth were invented because of very, very extreme problems or different problems that we had in space. And in a way, everything was already designed. It's very, very hard to invent something new. But taking yourself outside of here, somewhere else with different environments and conditions really can help you do that. So in many ways, a lot of things that maybe I can think of or other space architects can think of about certain habitats or environments, maybe we would never get to those conclusions if we would have tried to stay here on Earth. With our imagination, with our wild imagination and everything, and we can be talented and everything, but maybe if we will not get out to space, we will not be able to think of some of the solutions that we can think of.
Wow, wonderfully said. Maybe a little bit of a contradictive question, because you said that you're not watching any science fiction movies, but do you have recommendations on reading, listening, or watching anything related to space architecture?
Yeah, I was thinking about that question. Thinking about what can I bring? What can I recommend? Because space architecture, if you Google space architecture, you wouldn't find much. But the way that I got into it and the way I learned more about it, and the way I get excited about it is just generally reading and listening about space in general. So first of all, there are amazing Netflix series. There is an amazing Netflix series called Mars that I did watch, I admit. And the reason why it's amazing is because it's half scripted and half interviews with real NASA scientists and Elon Musk and other players of the space industry. And it's about the future, potential future on Mars. So that's very interesting. And I recommend watching it. Another thing is you can see there is a very amazing organization that I love. Its founder, Vera Muliani, it's called Mars City Design. And they are amazing. They are doing constant competitions of space architecture and Martian architecture. So you can really get a lot of ideas from that. Also, NASA is doing a lot of competitions about materials and about space architecture. Another thing is that This year, it was my second year to join the Humans to Mars Summit by Explore Mars as a space architect. And I really think that one of the problems of the space industry today is that it is very, very hard to find things. I mean, you have to be very enthusiastic about space in order to understand what's happening, because the space industry is not great with communication or to explain things to the outside world. And I think that's something that the space industry should really, really work on, because it is part of everyone. It is part of humanity. It's going to be the future of humanity. So it's really start digging and go down the rabbit hole. I mean,
well, let's make the start easy. When we want to start with this quest to information, where can we find you online? What's your website?
So my website is called thezizo.com, which is THEZISO. So there you can see not only my Earth and space architectural projects, you can also see videos from my different talks, from the Humans to Mars Summit, Instagram and LinkedIn. Just write my name, Zizo, and you can find me there, and Facebook and Twitter. I'm all over the place.
Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation and sharing your knowledge and enthusiasm for this relatively new discipline.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I had such a good time. I can talk about this forever. And I think also we talked about this before, the conversation went in different directions. I think space is really something that kind of gets your imagination going. I mean, there's no way around that. Thank you so much for having me.
For more information, links and show notes, visit scientificimagination.org.